Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll hear more of my talk with Oscar-winning filmmaker, writer, and artist William Joyce, and we'll have a poetry reading by Chris Hannon. Today we'll hear more of my conversation with Shreveport filmmaker and writer William Joyce, whose new book and Oscar award-winning film are both called The Fantastic Flying Books of Mr. Morris Lesmore. This event was recorded June 22nd at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts after a screening of the film. Today we'll hear from Bill about his friendship with the legendary New Orleans character Colleen Sally and her expletives of endearment. Now, one of the important parts of this book is, I mean, the movie and the book, is the power of story. And one person who influenced your ideas about stories is Colleen Sally. Mm-hmm. And I remember you have this great story about taking Colleen to Pixar, I think, to talk about story and what it really meant.
Well, actually, it went the other way around. I brought Pixar to Colleen.
Oh, right.
So, you know, I'd started at Pixar when they first started. And worked on Toy Story and had become good friends with all those guys, you know, John Lasseter and Pete Docter and Andrew Stanton and Joe Ramp and the guys who they call the brain trust there. And but you know, there were just some guys who had never made a movie before, much less made the first computer animated film. And so we got along, we became friends. And John was having his birthday in New Orleans. He said, "I love New Orleans. I've only been there once, and you talk about it all the time, Bill. I want to have my birthday in New Orleans." I was like, "It's perfect. You know, I know exactly. I'll figure out the restaurants. And there's this woman you have to meet."
And people have to realize Bill lives in Shreveport, but he's a New Orleanian too, really.
Well, I mean, we've been coming here. I was telling Joe today, we've lived here like for months at a time ever since I was five. And when I was a kid, we were down there a lot. My parents were always afraid of the city, though. I was the one running outside going, "This is cool." You know, even as a little kid, they're like, "You're going to get killed. You're going to be mugged. You're going to get killed. And nobody here knows how to drive." And, you know.
Still true.
And Mardi Gras is just, just don't even talk to us about Mardi Gras. And so we'd stay at the Columns Hotel, and I would sneak out on the balcony and watch the Mardi Gras parades. And it was just like, what has happened to planet Earth? This is so great. You know.
Yes.
Or have we gone into another orbit? What is, you know, up is down? I don't know, but I think this is fabulous. And my parents were like, "Get back in here." And anyway, so I bring John and all the Pixar guys and the head of Disney at the time, a fellow named Tom Schumacher. And we're staying at the Claiborne Mansion down, you know, right across from Claiborne Park and run by Cleo, who is, you know, a fabulous New Orleans eccentric.
And former bookseller, too.
And former bookseller.
Yeah.
And so we rented out the whole Claiborne Mansion, and I keep going, "Now we got to go see this woman, you know." And they're like, yeah, the bar's down here. "We'll go see her in a little while." I'm like, because we're being adults. We're doing what you do in New Orleans. We're drinking and eating and drinking and eating and drinking and eating. And so on a Sunday morning, this is in January, and it was that time it kind of snowed down here. It got icy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that doesn't happen a lot. So, I mean, I figure you guys remember it. And so... They're really hungover. They're like dying. They're so hungover. And I'm like, "Come on, we are going to see Colleen Sally." And they're just like, "What? What? There's got some old lady you want us to, like, I don't, what?" And I'm just, "Shut up. I mean, it's on the way to the bar. You're going to stop and, you know, you're going to get some of the hair of the dog, but she's probably got some good stuff too. And, you know, she's right here on charters. We're going down to the Napoleon House. Just shut up." And so Colleen knows we're coming, and so we knock on the door, and she swings open the door, and she's festooned in all these beads and her moo-moo, and she's already had, I don't know how many, but then she says, "Come on in, you expletives of endearment, expletives of endearments. You think you're hot, expletive of endearments, you know, excrements. from Hollywood. Get your sorry asses in here and sit down and shut the expletive up while I tell you some stories. Expletive, expletive, expletive. And they just stood there like, what has happened here? There's this awkward, and it was a genuinely awkward moment. Like, I don't know if this is working, you know? But she said that she had alcohol, so that kind of like, you know, got him in the door. And within 10 minutes, they were literally sitting at her feet. It's like she's sitting in her chair in that front room of her place on Charters, and it was definitely the Colleen chair, you know, like, and this high back, wing back chair. And she's sitting there, and they're all on the floor like little kids. And these were the titans of entertainment industry, men who control the fates of thousands of people and ran billions of dollars, and they're sitting there enraptured at the feet of this salty, you know, little lady from New Orleans and her expletives of endearment and her amazing storytelling ability. And so there is, you know, besides John, besides the, you know, the backbone of Pixar is Tom Schumacher, the head of Disney. And he's like, we have to get her to Disney. Just whatever, just you figure it out. I want her there. And I'm like, I get it. You know, We'll make that happen. She'll want to get paid. He's like, that's no problem. That's no problem. Well, Colleen was like, I'm there, honey. Well, and the wonderful thing was that they flew her out. They flew me first class. You know,
she loved that.
Oh, the drinks are free up there. I never knew. You know, and they had a limo for her and a driver, and they brought her in. She had no idea what they were going to have her do. And she was kind of like, I don't know, how much do I ask for? And I said, a lot.
You know, exactly. Just,
they've got money, Colleen. It's Disney, okay? But they brought her in, and it was the same story I just told you, but on a company-wide scale. They told other employees, you know, for 4 days, I think, we have a speaker, a lunchtime speaker. You will be in the auditorium from this time to this time, and you will listen to this woman. And they're all like, who, what? Who are they? Who is it? Some, I don't know. She's just some little old lady. What, we're going to, we make movies. Why are we going to see this? And then, you know, I was texting guys and going, I'm telling you, this is amazing. I mean, Tom Schumacher's making you do this for a reason. He is your boss, and he's not stupid, and you need to do this, and don't complain. You're going to thank me. And, like, I was sitting there looking at my watch going, okay, Colleen's going over because I hadn't heard from anybody. But, it, you know, as soon as it was, like, then the emails started coming in. Oh, my God. You know, they would say, now I remember why I'm in the movie business. Now I know why stories matter. Now, I mean, from all these jaded, you know, Hollywood guys, she reminded them what they were doing and why. And she talked to the entire company of Disney in shifts. So I don't know how many thousand people she talked to. And they brought her back several times to do that because she would rekindle that flame every time. So, you know, somehow I think they should call it like, you know, Disney, Deline car, Disney, I don't know. They have to like, maybe they should have a Colleen Sally ride, maybe, I don't know. But, you know, in a strange way, I think that she saved Disney.
She could do that to all of us. Yeah. I mean, she could turn us all into children right now if she were here. But I think that's sort of, you've taken that over now. You're turning us all into children.
Is that why I'm gaining weight?
Wow. Now I have to ask, what are the things that you created in this movie would you most have in your house, would you most like to possess?
Well, I have some of it.
You do?
Yeah. I mean, we decided to experiment with this short that we wanted to do. There are all these things that Brandon and I, my co-director, had always cherished in filmmaking and animation. One of them was miniatures, you know, that, and they still use miniatures a lot in movies. I mean, they make a lot of times when you see some giant castle, right, like in Lord of the Rings, it's sometimes it's CG and sometimes it's a miniature. It's like, you know, it depends on, you know, what the budget is, but, you know, you build a miniature version of this giant castle. And in old films, we really loved the way that looked. I mean, there was a certain fakery to it that was charming and handcrafted. And so we didn't want to, like, the computer does everything perfectly. So you could spend tons more time trying to program imperfections like you know, the scuffs on a floor and the denting around the edge of a piece of furniture that's been the same place forever. And then the way a book wears, it's really hard to get to tell the computer how to do that, to program it, to understand that and render it. So we thought it might be easier and maybe less expensive if we build all this stuff for real in miniature. So, and we decided to do that. And it was great fun. It may not have been the smartest thing, but I think it had an effect. I think that it feels warm. It feels like you can feel the human touch of having made these things by our hands. And Joe Bloom, who's here tonight, Joe designed all the buildings and did the blueprints for them. And did so much of the way this thing looks is due to Joe. And, but, you know, we had to build this stuff, right? So we had to have carpenters, and but they had to, like, build things 1/6 or 1/12 scale. And, you know, so they needed blueprints. I mean, they needed something to follow. And so Joe had to sit there and make these incredibly detailed, you know, drawings so that these guys could build this stuff. And once they'd build it, what was so funny, you know, none of these guys had built miniatures before. So we got these, mm-hmm. or some of them hadn't. And so they build it, and it looks perfect. And the first thing we do is take a Dremel to it and a hammer and just start tearing it up, you know, to make it look worn. So we built 6 blocks of the French Quarter. I mean, all the stuff at the beginning that you see were miniatures that we made. And Joe had not been to New Orleans at that point in time ever before. Now, he's been here a bunch since. And I was going, okay, look, the sidewalks are like this. Okay, and there's lots more potholes, okay? And the construction's like, the columns are dinkier than that. I mean, it's just, and he was like, this doesn't seem right. I'm like, look, trust me, it's right, okay? And I mean, so we're building this stuff and we're tearing it up, and a lot of the crew were just going, I don't know, I mean, does it look like this? I'm like, yeah, you know? You should go down Bourbon Street. You know, we're not going to paint in little vomit things on on the miniature, but, you know, they'd be there. And so I have some of those miniatures. The question was, what would I have in my house? And I have a few of the pieces. I love his bed. I love the little chair that he sits in. A lot of it's in storage, but some of it's at my house. And, you know, the thing is, we had to make 5,000 little books.
Wow.
And paint them. Uh-huh. By hand, and we designed everything so we could use our sets, we could move them around while we're shooting and shoot different like close-ups and things. But there's like that one shot when he first comes into the library, that's every prop we got, that's every book we got. We couldn't do anything else until we did those 2 shots, because that's like mm-hmm. all of it. And the rest of the time you kind of break it up because, you know, you don't need it, use it all. But we were busting so much expletive and, you know, of to get all these things done. And then there got to be a point where it's like, okay, these are going to be further away. These books are, so you don't have to paint them as good. You know, they're going to be kind of out of the shot. And then we finally kind of like we ran out and we needed more books. So we ended up, and this, I can't believe this worked. We made little printouts of photographs of stacks of books. And printed them out and mounted them on foam core and just had a little pedestal behind them to prop the whole thing up. But they weren't even really, they're just flat.
And oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's great what you can do when you just sort of, you know, the background's a little out of focus.
It looks warm. That's
what the thing. There you go. Thank you.
Chris Hannon is an attorney with Baker Donaldson Behrman Caldwell and Berkowitz. Chris is a New Orleans native and a 2004 graduate of the College of Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, and a 2008 graduate of the Loyola University College of Law. He lives in Mid-City with his wife, Emily, and his son, Jack William. He's the winner of the 2012 Tennessee Williams Poetry Contest. Hi, Chris. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
How did you find out you won that contest? I'm curious.
Well, I was actually probably bothering the people at the festival by emailing and making sure I'd followed all the rules with my submission and things like that. So it was an email from the committee who had selected the poem letting me know I had won. I guess it was either December or January ahead of the March festival. So, of course, I was thrilled when I got the news and immediately started calling all the family who some of them appear in the poems that won. So it was a good day for the family.
So tell us a little bit about how this poem, the poem that did win, is related to your family and what that reading at the festival was like for you.
Yeah, the poem is entitled The Nephilim, which is a reference to the race of people who were on the earth before the Great Flood in the Bible, which I know it's kind of a heavy and ominous thing, but that was kind of my intent in naming the poem. But the poem is about when my family and I returned to my grandmother's flooded home in Chalmette after Hurricane Katrina. It was probably about a month afterwards. And the area where her house was right near where one of the oil tanks had foundered. So there was water, mud, oil. I remember seeing minnows swimming in her garage, and it was totally surreal. But in any event, the main reason we went back to the house, because by that point we knew it was pretty much, you know, unsalvageable, was because my grandmother had left her jewelry box on her her dresser in her bedroom. And the only thing she was interested in getting back from the house was her wedding ring. Her husband, my grandfather, passed away when my dad was about 13, and him and his four siblings were at various ages at that point. So, but my grandmother always wore her wedding ring for the rest of her life, never remarried. So the only thing she wanted was her wedding ring. And I guess the second thing she wanted, too, was she had a high school ring from my grandfather that was in the same box. So we went to the house, had to basically kick in the front door to get in, and ultimately wound up pulling the front window frame off of the house because it was easier to get things in and out that way. There was about half a foot of mud, muck, oil, water, minnows throughout the house. And there was probably four or five of us there, some cousins, my aunt, my dad, and we basically just started digging through this muck and finding various things, old family photographs, clothes. My grandmother had a doubloon collection, a Mardi Gras doubloon collection, so none of it was even in the same room that it had been in before. It was really like digging back through time. So the poem talks about that, and then the main focus of the poem is it's actually a cycle of five poems, but the main focus is the process that we went through to find the ring. Best as we can figure, the jewelry box floated up off of the dresser and then at some point disintegrated. So there was jewelry. Basically what we did was we divided my grandmother's bedroom up into kind of quadrants and used the shovel to shovel the sediment. And then we were actually sieving it through a window screen using Diet Coke that had been left in her trunk because there was no running water.
So many people can identify with that, I know.
Yeah, it was, and the whole thing was just so, I mean, it felt like you were in a movie or a cartoon or some kind of, it was a very ancient and almost timeless scenario.
And how long did you have to wait before you were able to write about that? Or were you able to write about it quickly?
I wasn't able to write about it quickly, and it wasn't so much, I mean, it was a very emotional ordeal, but it wasn't so much the emotion that kept me from writing about it. It was trying to kind of distill what the experience meant. I mean, I knew it was something very, like I said, timeless, ancient that we were going through, but it was trying to figure out how to best present it so that people could understand. That was what took me a while. And I guess I didn't write the poems till probably 2010, so it was about 4 or 5 years.
Wow. And your grandmother was able to hear you read at the festival.
She was. She was there. She just turned 85 a couple weeks ago. So, yeah, she came to the festival and got to hear the reading. And that was probably the best part of the entire experience. Because, I mean, these poems really were meant as a kind of a gift to her and to the rest of my family to commemorate, you know, what we went through.
So you're going to read a part of The Nephilim for us today, right?
Yes. And the part I'm going to read, again, the poem is in five parts. The fourth part is kind of the crucial scene where we actually did find my grandmother's wedding ring in all the mud. And just by way of context, all the parts of the poem are basically subtitled after different themes in ancient myth. For example, the first part of the poem is called Deucalionids, which is a reference to the flood myth of Deucalion. And then it goes on from there. So the fourth part of the poem that I'm going to read is entitled Nequia, which is a reference to the stories in ancient Greek myth where someone speaks with the dead. Before we can return home, we must spend time probing the dead minnows decomposing in the bedroom, shards of windows staring like lifeless eyes from the dimness, and the inescapable mud that sticks thick as old blood to everything in the house, searching for the wedding ring my grandmother left behind in the flood. Below the oak root bend of arthritic knuckles, she still bears the mark, rubbed smooth as a riverbed, of wearing for 50 years this symbol of the man she loved, God, her family, and her home, now lost amid the remnants of rushing water and displaced earth. It is the only thing she hopes to take away from this place. From the door of the bedroom where her jewelry box disintegrated in the ruthless salt surge, we dig trenches 1 foot wide and deep, carrying the shovelfuls of spoil mixed with bits and pieces of her clothes, earrings, shoes, and bedsheets, out to the front lawn. With no running water, we sieve it all through a window screen, pouring Diet Coke from the trunk of her flooded car into the mud like a drink offering of honey, milk, wine, and blood to the ghosts that slowly reveal themselves as the dirt washes away in flashes of silver and gold, speaking to us of past lives and the memories welling in her eyes with every necklace and earring we unearth. We grasp at these apparitions before they slip through our hands and sink back into the blackness pooling like a lethe below the screen where the coke and sludge smell of asphodel. As the light fades, we begin to lose hope of finding this one thing she seeks in the destruction that will bring her back to her life before the flood. But then, the smiling curve of a plain gold ring swims up through the fetid bilge, reflecting the houses and the faces of you, your father, and your cousins standing over the screen. And as she slides it onto her hand, her eyes shine with thanks, and the streams of a different flood of salt no levees can contain.
That's an amazing poem, Chris.
Thank you.
Now, I have to ask you, if your colleagues at work, if your fellow attorneys read your poetry.
They do. Actually, it's funny. When the Tennessee Williams Festival results were announced kind of publicly on the Tennessee Williams Festival website, somebody apparently got wind of it and sent it to the whole office, which I... More than anything else, I just didn't want to have to deal with everybody emailing me and saying, can you please send me this stuff? But everybody was very, very happy and very excited for me. And I did send the poem around to the office after the announcement email went to the whole office. And everyone really enjoyed the poems. And I guess they were kind of surprised to find out that that was something I did. But
now, that's an unusual thing, an unusual email to get at a law firm.
Yes, I suspect. I think you're probably right.
All right. Well, John Grisham's got nothing on you, I'm sure.
Hopefully my books will be next to his one day on the bestsellers list. But
I hope so, too. Just keep it up. We've been talking with Chris Hannon, whose poem cycle, The Nephilim, won the 2012 Tennessee Williams Poetry Prize. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you, Susan. Appreciate it.
So cloudy, so cloudy. I believe it's gonna rain. I don't believe my woman love me. She in love with another man. Go look at the weather. I believe it's going to be a flood.
We're deep into summer now, so don't waste these long days. Treat yourself to a new book. Here's my recommendation for this week. The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry by British first novelist Rachel Joyce is one of the most purely delightful stories I've read this year. When Harold Fry, who's retired from the local brewery, receives a letter from his former friend and colleague Queenie Hennessy, he's upset to learn that she's writing to say goodbye, a final goodbye.
from a hospice. Suddenly, Harold is moved to action, to the surprise of his wife, Maureen. After heading to the post office, he decides he will set out and walk across the British countryside to Berwick-on-Tweed, believing that his pilgrimage will save Queenie Hennessy. As Harold continues his journey, wearing the most unsuitable shoes and clothes, without his cell phone, and plagued by blisters and cramps, he has time to think, and he remembers his life, rethinking the years of marriage and parenthood, remembering Queenie and their work life at the brewery. And like all the best journeys, his pilgrimage not only brings him to Queenie's bedside, but to a new understanding of himself. Here is a bit from Harold's journey. He visited the cathedral and sat in its chilled light, pouring like water from above. He reminded himself that centuries ago men had built churches, bridges, and ships, all of them a leap of madness and faith, if you thought about it. When no one was looking, Harold slipped to his knees and asked for the safety of the people he had left behind and those who were ahead. He asked for the will to keep going. He also apologized for not believing. Harold passed office workers, dog walkers, shoppers, children going to school, mothers and buggies, and hikers like himself, as well as several tourist parties. He met a tax inspector who was a druid and had not worn a pair of shoes for 10 years. He talked with a young woman on the trail of her real father, a priest who confessed to tweeting during Mass, as well as several people in training for a marathon and an Italian man with a singing parrot. He spent an afternoon with a white witch from Glastonbury and a homeless man who had drunk away his house, as well as 4 bikers looking for the M5 and a mother of 6 who confided she had no idea life could be so solitary. Harold walked with these strangers and listened. He judged no one, although as the days wore on and time and place began to melt, he couldn't remember if the tax inspector wore no shoes or had a parrot on his shoulder. It no longer mattered. He had learned that it was the smallness of people that filled him with wonder and tenderness, and the loneliness of that, too. The world was made up of people putting one foot in front of the other, and a life might appear ordinary simply because the person living it had been doing so for a long time. Harold could no longer pass a stranger without acknowledging the truth that everyone was the same and also unique, and that this was the dilemma of being human. He walked so surely, it was as if all his life he had been waiting to get up from his chair. So take a break from the Summer Olympics to work out with Harold Fry. You may be inspired to get up from your chair as well by this lovely, sweetly comic novel. It ends on a perfect note of hope regained, and isn't that a wonderful journey's end? Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. There will be an evening of fiction and poetry from several local and touring authors, represented by Aqueous Books of New Orleans, Ampersand Books of St. Petersburg, Florida, and Prick of the Spindle Literary Journal. The event takes place at Maple Street Bookshop Uptown, Wednesday, July 25th at 6 p.m. Here are the readers. Carissa Halton reads from her novella, The Mere Weight of Words. Ben Rogers from his novel, The Flamer. Poets Derek Medina, Clark Terrio, Thaddeus Conti, Benjamin Lohenkron, Eric Elliott, and Carrie Causey also read. And Ryan Holiday discusses and signs Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator, Tuesday, July 31st at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.